Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, my name is Bruce Norris. Thank you for joining us. Once again, we are joined by Ward Hannigan. Ward Hannigan is a very experienced trustee sale buyer. He's the president of Innovest, and he's one of the foremost foreclosure experts in the state of California. Ward, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you, Bruce.
I was just going to mention something. You complimented me one time that you never heard anybody say anything bad about me. I will return that compliment. You are one of the people that people think very highly of and have for a long time. So I assume that your business model really tries to treat people right, and your reputation says that. So that's real important to me.
Yes, but you know something? I don't really do it because it's the right thing to do. I'm more selfish. I learned somehow, some way, that if I don't charge for mentoring, that I let people come back after the training and ask me all kinds of questions, that it's their constant calling me back over the years that forces me to stay current, forces me to stay sharp, forces me to be on top of my game. And I tell trainees, if you didn't call me, I would pay you to call me so that I, you know, don't go to seed.
Well, any way it happens, it's working. That's good. We've got a giant foreclosure mess nationally, and California is pretty much one of the epicenter states just because of our population, but our price decline is ridiculous. And they've taken several measures to try and stem the problem. One of them was a document, I think it was 1137, mm-hmm. that put some new twist on the foreclosure process. How do you think that affected the amount of foreclosures that ultimately occurred?
It didn't. It did was it just bunched them up while the lenders scrambled to accommodate those new requirements. It's basically a little more hand-wringing and a little more phone numbers and yada, yada, yada for people at the front end of the foreclosure. With me working the back end, you know, at the sale, it interrupted the supply coming in the pipeline for a while, but now it's back open to being a gusher again.
Did they do any other adjusting? I'll tell you one thing they did in that document that has definitely been a negative for the lender is they've been fining the lender on a regular basis. Almost every REO we buy has a fine attached to it. And we met with one of the cities, and they had hired commissioned-only people as code enforcement. The second that trustee's deeds records going back to the lender, mm-hmm. they go out and inspect the property. And in one of our recent boot camps, we actually visited a house that was a first-day listing that was priced well. And when we went to see it, it had already been red-tagged. And we read the infraction, and it was a stolen porch light with two wires coming out.
Wow.
That was a $1,000 fine.
Yeah.
We closed a transaction where that fine had accumulated, because if you don't take care of it, it keeps kind of growing.
Right.
$15,000.
Right.
So they're inadvertently causing motivation for the lender.
Yeah.
And that's kind of good.
Yeah, it is. And we have it in San Diego where, you know, they go, I mean, there's a foreclosure, I mean, it's an REO, all of a sudden, they're looking at pools. Neighbors can rat fink on the lender by saying, here's a pool, and then guts come on it, and there's, the vile virus is going to be, explode. And,
mm-hmm.
and they have some really, as you mentioned, daily fines that can really be punitive. Even for a lender, they can be punitive because you take that and multiply it times, 300 houses in the area, and you got a lot of money going on.
Yeah, that's the thing. The quantity of the foreclosures almost prevents them from getting crews out there. They would have to hire half the contractors in California. I hadn't thought of this, but bringing it up. But California, each individual city and county have been given millions and millions of dollars to buy these REOs and fix them up and do several things to them. I just wondered what you thought that impact might be.
I think that impact's positive. I like it because a lot of those millions are going towards first-time buyer assistance programs where that's where I want to focus and buy my homes as first-time buyers and entry-level housing. So if I can shoehorn a buyer into one of my deals that I'm reselling because the city is giving them a 10% assistance and down payment or something like that, more power to them.
They just got an $8,000 tax credit, too.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's pretty much their down payment, FHA. So that's a good thing. Your thoughts on the new $75 billion Foreclosure Prevention Act?
My thoughts are basically it's much to do about nothing, mainly because no one's talking about the fact that about 40% or more of all foreclosures are not owner-occupied. These are properties, surplus properties that people unwisely bought, speculating in, and now they're letting them go. So they're not really losing their own home. They're losing, you know, an investment, and these programs don't make any attempt to help you not lose your investment. And so when you got, I saw a low number of 40, but I think it's probably even higher, of percent of all these foreclosures are non-owner-occupied, the owner-occupied Obama bills doesn't help it.
Now, that's interesting you bring that up. Where did that stat come from? Because
I can look it up. It's just like a day or 2 days ago. I saw it. It's either in like Time magazine or it's in my newspaper.
Okay. I would love to see that because when I look at you get the county records research list, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. When you have that asterisk and you have an address below, mm-hmm. you know, that's a sign that it's a non-owner occupant property.
Right.
And in Riverside, I would say 70% of the list, approaching 70%, is a simultaneous first and a second.
Mm-hmm.
Which, am I wrong in thinking that that probably was a great percentage of the time an occupant?
You would think so.
You would think so.
I've talked to guys that come to me with their own problems, saying, "Ward, what should I do? Should I jettison this stuff? Let it go? How's it going to affect my credit? This and that." And almost always, it's not their house; it's this other stuff that they just bought, you know, pre-construction or condos downtown and all that kind of stuff. And I find out that they got 100% financing for that stuff.
Did they say they were going to live in it, or that's how generous the loan programs got?
I think that's how generous they got. I think the only requirement is, can you fog a mirror, and they gave you the loan. You know?
Can you hold your hand steady enough to sign the loan docs?
Right.
That's it. Aye, aye, aye. There were a lot of people that were convinced 2005 and 6 would go on forever. And I'm sure you were talking to some of those people during those years. What did you say to people that were just optimistic that this was going to be the norm?
Well, you know what was embarrassing is because if you know more than the average person or you think it through like you do or I do, we get accused of crying wolf because we can see it so far in advance of when it really comes and hits that people say, you know, I shouldn't have listened to you last year because, you know, I sold my house, but if I kept another year, I could have got another 40. And I'm going, my God, at least you didn't lose anything, you know. So, you know, I mean, I'd much rather be ahead of the game than behind the game, you know. And so I was getting really frustrated in those days because year after year I was saying, man, watch it, don't do it. You know, this is too much. This success is just mind-boggling. And people, and they were right. They go, and they go out and do it and make another $30,000-$40,000 in 3 months, you know.
Yeah, that was frustrating. But this time, it was really very artificial numbers we got to, and I guess that's why we've given them back so fast.
Mm-hmm.
They never should have gotten to the number they got to.
Right, absolutely right.
You know, when it hits, there's a lot of people that got underwater extremely quickly. And I think that's one thing that's been very different about this downturn is that you have a ton of people that went from a positive equity position to a negative in a 6 month to a 9 month period where there was literally no exit.
Right.
And I think that's why most of these are turning into bank owned properties.
Mm-hmm.
When you looked into this the future, let's say in 2006 and 2007, how did you personally prepare for this downturn?
Basically, all I did was I set up some line of credits. I never expected that if I had great credit and I owed nothing against property, you know, I've got 20-some-odd properties I own free and clear that I could put in place lines of credit on them and not even borrow it yet, not pull the trigger. And so I thought, okay, I'll get that in place. I have a couple million bucks. And I was doing that sort of thing. I did some spec building, and that worked out great, build a little McMansion and sell it. Way overpriced.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm one of these guys that's part of the problem because I sold something for you know, $600,000 more than what it was worth, you know, stuff like that. I mean, not worth. It was worth that at the time.
At the time. You know, that's the thing. That, what can you do? There's people that want it and people that would even line up to get it.
Exactly.
So,
in fact, the people that bought it still got it, still keep it, fell in love with it. So I feel happy about that.
You and I are in the training business. We talk to people all the time that have literally lost everything they have. What do you say to people that have used to have substance and now they're starting over from scratch?
The most thing I do, and I plead with them, to be a survivor, not a victim.
Yes.
Do not blame anything, anybody, even not yourself. Don't. All right? You got caught up in this euphoria. There was a group type thing. And so what you do is you've got to focus on being a survivor, okay? This will, you can put this behind. Time does heal all wounds. Start over again. And so just pick up your pants, pull your belt in real tight, and, you know, and don't grumble, mumble, this and that. Just get on with life. You know, if you saw my license plate down here, the holder of my license plate says suffering is optional. And I really believe in that.
Okay.
I really, really do believe in that. And it's not what happens to you, it's how you react to what happens to you.
Well, you know, in the foreclosure business, when you talk to people that are in foreclosure, that's one of the most successful things you can do to get them to sell a property is to have them look beyond their current circumstances mm-hmm. to the future and feel the relief of getting out of their current circumstance.
That's right.
And that's exactly what you're saying to investors. Okay, this happened. You have a choice. You sit there and dwell on it and let it ruin the next few years. Or you just learn from it and then go about getting your share of the goodies now. I hear all the time, and I've heard it from some people every quarter since 2000, this is the best time to buy real estate. How do you see 2009 and 10 as perhaps the most discounted market you've ever seen?
Yeah, I think it's going to be incredibly discounted as you get these option arm resets and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, the graphs, you and I both see them, of the looming war clouds coming up are even higher than what we've gone through.
Yes.
So, yeah. But, you know, I look at it this way. I like to eat every day, as you know.
Yeah, I'm on that club, too.
Yeah. And so I want to make money, you know, through thick and thin.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't matter to me if it's thick and thin. I intend to make money in thin markets and fat markets and this and that. And so it doesn't bother me that, you know, something I bought 10 years ago, today I can sell for four times as much. Now, at the time I sold, it was a great deal. And I just go from great deal to great deal to great deal, given the market I'm in. And so I don't try to hit the absolute high and the absolute low and this and that. Nah, just right now at this time, in this market, in this neighborhood, what's a great deal? And that's what I try to hit.
How important is it in your philosophy to take care of the monthly nut on automatic pilot at some point?
Oh, man. If you go to my website, you know, foreclosureforum.com, and click on the Dingbat Retirement Plan,
mm-hmm.
I actually feel, you know, I just feel that my life's a bliss, absolutely a bliss, because I was lucky, not smart, but I was lucky enough to latch on to this mindset of having getting my keepers free and clear. And that gives me cash flow now that I just, you ever feel smug? I'm good at it. I think I got a doctorate degree in smug, because I sit here and I had this big grin because I got guaranteed income from Section 8 senior citizen rentals coming in on 16 of my 23 properties. And no matter what happens, I mean, everything can go to hell. You could stop trains. You could stop planes. You could stop, I don't care, stop everything. Stop the rivers from flowing. You know, I'm going to get my transfer payments from Section 8 coming into my bank account every single month.
They haven't sent you an IOU yet, have they?
Never.
Oh, okay.
Never send me an IOU.
Okay.
And people aren't going to move, all right, because all they got to pay is 10% of the rent, and the government and you and all the other people listening are paying me the other 90%.
Do you feel that having put yourself in that position has allowed you to make very much, much calmer decisions?
Absolutely, and I never compromise those properties for my money making game.
Absolutely,
it's a separate thing. I never touch those, And people say to me, my God, you know, if you sold those 16 properties, Ward, when the heyday, you'd be worth, you know, another $14 million. And I say, yeah, right, but I pay taxes on it. Now they have the cash, and then where am I going to generate the 22 to 23 that's coming in every month?
You know? Absolutely.
Blah, blah, blah. No.
Now, you also chose to rent to a very unique group of people.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, it was a learning experience. Most people, they do it, you know, they do this business backwards. They get a house however way, you know, and then they try to jam a tenant in it, all right? I look at it like you would a computer. You know, you don't go out and buy hardware and then try to figure out how to get the software in it. You figure out the software needs first, okay, and then go out and buy the hardware to match. Well, the hardware in the real estate business is the house. Software is your tenant. So you figure out what kind of tenant do you want. You want someone that'll stay forever? You want someone that's going to pay you forever? You want someone that's not going to need hand-holding and all that kind of stuff? And that's what I wanted, because I figure when I retire, when I do, what I wanted was I wanted freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be wet-nosing somebody, you know, who's whining because they don't know how to, you know, restart the garbage disposal. So I decided that I found out just by self-examination of previous records that I had on rental that I didn't hate all tenants. There were certain tenants that, God, I thought those were great people. And the commonality was they're all retired.
Mm-hmm.
And then a light bulb went on. I said, wow, you know, I want to rent to someone in the last 20 years of their life. I don't want the first 20, the middle 20. I want the last 20 years of their life when now you don't have the volatility of a family expanding or declining, and those expansions and declines in family size cause turnover. I don't want someone that's got a job. Job's the worst thing you can have for a tenant, because when his job is threatened or he has no overtime and this and that, they want to move into a cheaper place, or he's making more money, wants to go into a grander place. So that leads to volatility. So I wanted people who were settled as far as family size was down to them. And as far as income, it's a guaranteed income coming from Social Security and some rental subsistence with Section 8.
What's the common thread on the property type they want?
They want something that, you know, when you get to be 70, all of a sudden these false pretensions of, you know, you're embarrassed to be thrifty, and you're embarrassed because you don't have, you know, you're not keeping up with the Joneses when you're 70. You're not embarrassed to be thrifty and on. Well, senior citizens always think, no matter how much money they have, that they're going to live longer than the money they've got.
Mm-hmm.
And so they become quite thrifty. They also, I think, and when you hit 70, and I'm 1 year away, that the deserve gene kicks in.
Okay.
You live 70 years, you deserve some peace and quiet. I don't know where that comes from, but it's pretty common that you deserve some peace and quiet.
Okay.
So, you know, the old business saw, you know, that if you want to get rich, what you do is figure out what your client wants and then give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, I had to figure out who my client was. Big leap. I found out, oh, my client is a retiree that is healthy enough to be able to live in their own place. What do they want? They want peace and quiet. So they want a separate unit. They don't want to listen to other people's noises in a common wall or smell their cooking odors and this and that. Hey, I've done it all my life. I want some peace and quiet.
Mm-hmm.
They don't turn their nose up because the property doesn't have a garage, because they don't have the need for a car. You know, they're not being a family chauffeur. They're not going to work and all that stuff. So a garage doesn't mean anything. They don't care if it doesn't have a big yard, because they're not going to get on these 70, 80-year-old knees to, you know, take care of it. And so they like something that is as thrifty as possible, one bedroom. You know what I had to do one time, Bruce? I bought a two-bedroom. I actually took the closet out of one of the bedrooms. And I advertise it as one, okay? Because then, and I tricked the senior into thinking it's a one-bedroom, one bath. Because if he thought he was renting a two-bedroom, he would want to move out and get into one bedroom, because that probably would be cheaper. So I took the closet out, and so if I ever sell it, I'll put the closet back in. It'll be a two-bedroom.
Now, are there that many of the? I mean, I've got to assume that these homes are 1930s and below.
Yes, in fact, actually, like 1920, but. You just figure Riverside, where was it in the 1920s? It was still around, and so you find it. Now the city's grown way out beyond it, but they're in the now center city.
Yeah, they're definitely center city, but are they what would you say about the type of safety of the neighborhood? That's got to be a very big deal.
It doesn't have to be super safe.
Really?
Yeah, because you just buy the grandmas of all the guys that are making it unsafe. or rent them. But what they want is they want level ground. They don't want to be walking up and down hills because they have this. They almost have this primal fear of falling and breaking a hip.
Right.
They don't want to be in a real, real, real crime zone where you get lulled to sleep every night with the rotors of the helicopters overhead.
Right.
Because senior citizens know that they can't run, they can't fight, and they can't really easily get out of harm's way. So they're not afraid of losing their money. They really aren't. It's just getting knocked down or broken bones in the process. And so I had 9 units, all on one big lot, but 9 separate little houses, cottage-type things in East San Diego. And the seniors, it was just a doll area, but the seniors would not rent there because they had this fear that the crime was so rampant that they probably, would be easy victims. But I have people down in Nasty City, they're not the greatest neighborhoods, and they just love it. They're comfortable because it's not overwhelmingly, crime infested.
I was going to ask you what type of ad you run that is legally worded, but I see that you eliminate most of the people that you wouldn't want because they just don't want that inventory.
Yes, and the other thing I did, exactly, because it's one, who wants a one-bedroom, one-bath? When's the last time you were at a cocktail party or, talking to investors and say, man, I built this one-bedroom, one-bath house, so you should see it. But the way I find tenants, first of all, my turnover, and this is not an exaggeration, is once every 17 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Mrs. Soyo recently died. She lived in my property 17 years before I bought it in 86, and another 22 years after that. So that was, what,
39 years?
Years.
Oh, my gosh.
And then...
Now she's hurt the average, though. No, she helped
the
average.
One of the things I really am frustrated with is she didn't give me a notice that she was going to kick the bucket. And I think that's a little unfair.
One of the things that you're kind of pointing out is this inventory type really is not of high desire. And in a downturn, that type of inventory gets crushed in price.
Let me tell you, my properties went, the one-bedroom, one-bath, all right, went up to over 300,000 during that nonsense euphoria, right?
Right.
And now those houses are back down to around 60.
60 in that
and
area.
And I get 850 for rent. You know that old 1% rule.
Yeah.
Wow, and I'm back in the clover again.
So you're going to start accumulating more.
Yeah. I got enough, but you know me, it's overachieve things.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, you own these things that went from 300 to 60, and that's not bad.
Right.
That's good.
Yeah. I'm the only guy. When I first thought of this, I thought I needed a retirement plan that could withstand the worst market we ever got to. To me, that was the American Depression, because that's what we studied when I took economics at UCR. And I said, okay, I've got to have a plan that would even withstand the Depression, because I'm not all that positive that these current politicians are any smarter than the ones who were back in the 30s. And, wow, look at me now. I mean, I couldn't imagine being able to safely, I could safely outride anything they throw at me because, I'm not paying mortgages.
Yeah, having a low debt level is very smart. We got a minute left. Fannie just raised their loan limits to 10 for investors. Smart move?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm hoping that's a change of attitude, because one of the things I noticed when President Obama was giving his talk about the $75 billion, he said that this program only helps owner-occupants, not real estate speculators, and there was a big applause. And I think there's a lot of confusion between a speculator and an investor.
I do, too. And I think you need speculators because they actually bring liquidity to whatever market it is. I don't care if it's coconuts or, the stock market or the real estate market. You absolutely need speculators to keep the volatility going and moving.
But we also need investors to take up the excess inventory because they're not going to be owner-occupants enough to do it.
But I don't think you're going to, 10's great, but I would tell you people in the audience that then you got to still work on a system where when you start getting more than 10, you can still do it and not have to, kiss Fannie Mae's ring.
That's right. Well, Ward, I've had fun. And once again, your website?
Once again, it's www.foreclosureforum.com.
All right. Ward, thanks a lot for joining us.
Betcha, Bruce.
Okay.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.